Welcome to the BizTech Review. I'm your host, Roger Green. Sit back and relax while I have interesting conversations with the people who are shaping the future of business and technology. My very special guest on this episode of the BizTech Review is Vint Cerf, a regular visitor on our podcast. I always look forward eagerly to my conversations with Vint because he is a man who has not only shaped the future of technology, but keeps on doing it. A true technology pioneer, Vint is the co-inventor of TCP/IP and the Internet with his colleague Bob Kahn. These days, Vint is a vice president at Google and chief Internet evangelist, where he is responsible for identifying new enabling technologies and applications on the Internet and on other platforms for the company. It is truly a treat to have Vint with us today. Vint, welcome back to the BizTech Review. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's always a pleasure to chat.
Vint, a while ago, we were talking about some of the emerging features on mobile phones and cellular technology, and you had talked about the geolocation of data and how that was influencing the development of Google Maps and other applications. I think a few things have happened since then. Maybe you could bring us up to date on that topic.
Well, it certainly has grown quickly, and I'm not surprised at the level of interest in geolocated data,
right?
Because we're seeing, at Google anyway, a very clear preponderance of queries that are related to where you are if you happen to have gear that connects you to the Internet and also is aware of its location, mobiles being a good example of that. So I don't think, however, that the kind of a futuristic view that as you walk by a store, a coupon suddenly leaps out at you from your mobile is a likely scenario. I think that's probably just over the top. But the idea that you could be aware of what is going on, be aware of people that you know who are in the area, if they choose to let you know that, things along those lines are quite likely, and in fact, they're quite visible. You see these as variations on social networking. So I think that we're going to see more and more of the kind of application which helps you discover what things you can do and maybe when you can do them. So this is the other interesting point is that geographically indexed information is useful not simply instantaneously as a function of where you happen to be at the moment, but also for planning purposes. You know, if I am going to be at a certain location at a certain time, what else is going on? That just underscores the utility of having geographically indexed information and maybe also time indexed information so that you have some ability to look forward into the future or into the past. Say, what happened? I was there. What was going on around me at the time that I was there?
Yes, I see that Google is really a major player in this and providing a lot of interesting applications along the way as well. And obviously, this is a case of connecting the dots because you've got a lot of this data now, and simply connecting more things to it really leverages it.
I think that's exactly right. In fact, let me give you another example. There's a very successful researcher at UCLA. His name is Deborah Estrin. She runs the Center for Embedded Network Sensing, and one of her foci at the moment is to look at the mobile phone as a mobile sensor. If it has GPS capability, it could record locally where you have been during the course of the day. You know, why might you want to do that? Well, one answer is that you could send that list of locations to a system that then could tell you, you were within two blocks of an exposure to typhoid or, other hazardous, situation. Things that would help you improve your ability to detect, early onset of a problem. Things of that kind could be useful. The other possibility is that the mobile device itself is equipped with sensor capability with your permission, could report the detection of something at a given location. So I can imagine harnessing these mobile devices increasingly as sensor tools in addition to communication and information portals.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. You really have almost a mesh, I guess you would call it, of devices that can provide, when you combine all the data that they're accumulating, quite a different view of what's going on.
Exactly. Now, the interesting thing is that these devices are typically where people are.
Right. So
that's both good and bad. It is good in the sense that it gives you substantial and potentially continuous coverage in locations that are populated. The other side, of course, is that if you don't have the sensors where people are not, then you don't know about what's going on there. So you still need to supplement such an architecture with the additional sensors that will be beneficial.
Well, I'm hoping that you can also tell me why I shouldn't worry about this. You know, it's we naturally, especially with some of the events that have occurred in the past 6 months, and let's say our massive disappointment with the integrity of certain industries and things like that, that all of this information could potentially be misused and abused. What's your thought on that?
Well, like you, I share a great deal of concern about privacy and its potential loss. It does seem as if privacy has become a very, very difficult commodity to obtain, certainly if you look over the last several decades. Although I have to tell you that privacy is an interesting concept, because if you lived in a small town, everybody knew what everybody was doing. It just had nothing to do with technology. It just had everything to do with small towns.
That's true.
So we may look back and imagine that with nostalgia that there was a golden period of privacy. Anonymity probably came largely with large cities, and generally not so much with small towns. And it's the introduction of new technology which has taken the anonymity away, even from the large cities.
That's an interesting point. And I've actually heard it said that there's some belief that, let's say, people's behavior changes when they're accountable. In other words, when your behavior is highly visible to people who you respect and who respect you, you might behave a little differently if it were visible than anonymous. So it could be that some of the fondness we have for the good old days of living in little towns may partly be related to that.
It's possible. Of course, just to use an analogy, people are visible in their automobiles, and they even have identifiers publicly displayed called the license plate. And although, in theory, the general public isn't able to map the license plate into somebody's name, I suppose for a number of people are capable of doing that, even if they shouldn't. But the more important thing is that you're supposed to be accountable for the way you drive. And in spite of that, I know that there are people who drive rather badly. So the inhibiting effect is not 100% clear.
I'm sure that's true. Well, at least there's hope. In other words, like most things, it's not either all dark or light. It's obviously gray, and we have to have some confidence in our ability as sensible people to try to make this work for us and not become in essence enslaved by the technology. And I'm optimistic.
Well, I hope. I certainly share your optimism. One thing I would point out is that people are often very concerned about abuse on the net, and that it's exacerbated by being able to conduct these abusive behaviors anonymously. And sometimes this translates into you have to get a license to use the internet, or you have to identify yourself precisely before you can use it. And there are some countries that are considering legislation along those lines. I guess I fall into a slightly different frame of mind. I think it actually is important that there be ways to identify yourself unambiguously to another party. But the reason for that is that there may be a transaction taking place in which both parties need to be assured of the other's identity. But one doesn't have to know that in all circumstances. So I'd be more inclined to say, look, anonymity is okay, and sometimes actually rather valuable.
I agree.
The whistleblower effect, for example. But there also should be agreed and standard ways of demanding high quality authentication, The other party doesn't necessarily have to accede to it, but then you could refuse to go on with the transaction in the event that the other party doesn't provide adequate bona fides.
Right.
And so I think that's the balance that I would strike in this particular instance.
I think that's a good point, and one that requires some thought to really comprehend, but I think it's a very good point. Vint, there's kind of a thread to the conversation today that I'd like to introduce at this moment. Again, we find ourselves in frightening times in many ways, and maybe even unprecedented in terms of the unpredictability of where our economy is going and how people are going to be making their livings in the future. And all of these things that we're going to be talking about today, and especially the first one, they all have embedded in them opportunities for innovation and for people to invent things and create, you know, revenues and sales and personal, you know, income opportunities. And it seems to me that besides all of the obvious Facebook, it's nice to see where your friend, what he's thinking at this moment in time, but all of these, and I think most of the technologies we're going to talk about today, present interesting opportunities for people who are looking for new ways to survive. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. And in fact, one of the things that I always worry about is that in our efforts to expand access to the internet, to provide broader band access as well, that we will somehow erode some of the openness of the net, which has invited so much creativity and innovation. I hope that we can find a way to preserve that aspect of the network, because it really has created enormous opportunities for many, many people.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you bring that up. And one of the other items I wanted to ask you about this morning was Obama's Rural Broadband Initiative, which I've seen jokingly referred to as the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority of the 21st century, and getting this broadband access out to the most remote corners of the country. What's your view on this in terms of the efficacy of it? You know, can we do it, and the kinds of technologies and what outcomes might result?
Well, let's see. On the first top level, of course, I think having broadband everywhere is a good thing. So attempts to do that, I generally am supportive of. Then the question will be, well, who will provide that broadband capability?
Exactly.
Under what conditions? There's a looks to me like there might be a bias in the formulation of the program that would favor incumbents as opposed to any new entrants. I may be wrong about that, so my recommendation here would be to look carefully at the terms and conditions of the legislative package in order to make it a determination yourself. But my concern here is that the incumbent broadband carriers have a mixed record with regard to the way in which they provide their services. And that mixed record gives me some pause, because I'm worried that the openness of the net will be eroded by restrictive broadband access policies that don't contribute to innovation. So that's the only area where I'm a little concerned. The other one, of course, is that if I remember correctly, the number is about $7.2 billion.
Right.
And
right.
I'm pretty sure that that's a very modest sum relative to what's actually required.
I think you're right.
And finally, there's an open question in my mind about which technologies are likely to be the most appropriate for providing rural broadband access. My guess is that we'll get different answers depending on where we go. You know, in a rugged mountainous area like Vermont and New Hampshire, you might find that pulling cable is difficult. So radio-based things might help. On the other hand, radio connectivity is difficult in where you don't have good line of sight. Then you get up into Oregon, you get highly forested areas, and satellite doesn't work very well because the trees occlude the transmission. And then you discover that local radio has the same problem, and so now you're back to pulling cable again. And maybe it's a mix of pulling cable or pulling optical fiber and then putting radio at the end some way in order to minimize some of the physical implementation and provisioning costs. I think it's going to take some real creativity to invent solutions that work well in these various circumstances. And I hope that the attempt to stimulate it will be done in a way that really does open up opportunity for new ideas, as opposed to simply propagating existing solutions, which may not necessarily work very well.
Absolutely. And I share your, let's say, caution, at least, if not actual pessimism about the traditional players having control of this, because we read all the time about Europe in particular, some of the Nordic countries having gigabit connections to their homes routinely for $15 a month. And in this country, we pay a lot more for a lot less. And I guess that's sort of the flip side of the coin of getting all this access.
Exactly. So, we will see, how this all works out. The TVA and the other related Rural Electrification Act actually, as I recall, included low interest loans, not only for electrical power distribution, but also telephone service.
I believe that's right.
And that seems to have worked out reasonably well, although I think looking at it from today's perspective, the rural telephone carriers, for example, I don't think have kept pace technologically with a lot of the larger incumbents. And that's a concern, because one doesn't want to put together a program that leads to sort of a stagnation over the long term. So I'm not sure how to solve that problem, and I'm sure that I've just insulted some of the smaller carriers who really have done well. So I don't mean to tar everyone with some very broad brush. But those are issues that arise, and something that needs to be considered.
Yeah, typically competition is the best cure for that kind of stagnation.
It is, Roger, although, sorry for just breaking in like this, one thing that I do worry about is the market that is capable of sustaining competition may not exist. And so then you get into this awkward problem of, okay, if I can't have competition, then A, what can I do to stimulate willingness to provide the service at all? And B, how can I make sure that the service is provided in a way that maintains this openness that leads to innovation? And that probably translates into some forms of regulatory oversight.
Well, that brings us to another interesting area, Vint. And I've been reading recently, although it hasn't been widely publicized, about Google's initiative in the Power Project using the smart meters. And I'm sure you're aware of it. I'm not sure all of our listeners have even heard of it. Maybe you'd explain a little bit what it is, and in the context of what you just said, which is that we have a lot of monolithic power companies who are utilities, and they have a monopoly in the area where they work. We expect some of this to change with solar and things of that sort, but right now they really do have an iron grip on people's consumption of energy. Electrical energy. And explain a little bit about what Google is doing in this area and how you think this is perhaps going to mitigate a bit some of this lack of progressive and innovative approach that utilities have built into them.
Okay, you've actually wrapped a good many different topics together in question. So let me start out by saying that the power meter idea is motivated in part by smart grid ideas. The smart grid notion says basically it would be really nice if not only could we adapt generation, that is to say supply of electrical energy, to the demand, which is what we have had to do up until now, but if we could also adapt the demand to the supply. If it were possible to shut off certain appliances that are electrical energy consuming for brief periods in order to clip peak loads, you would have the benefit of not building capital or not spending capital to build plant that gets used a small percentage of the time.
Right.
Because if it only gets used a small percentage of the time, then the cost per kilowatt hour is very high.
Right.
So you want to, if you have the flexibility to do this sort of control, it's of real interest. power meter is intended to assist in that. But of course, you also need to have some ability to direct energy to or shut energy or demand off from specific appliances. So this means that the appliances themselves have to be adaptable and willing to accept control. This leads to another issue, which relates to standards. And one of the hazards here is that the power companies have often adopted proprietary mechanisms to achieve this particular benefit. And I think Google has been arguing that what we need to do is to adopt common standards across the industry so that multiple parties can produce smart appliances and also smart metering equipment and have it all interwork. So there's still some, heavy lifting to be done to find what those standards should be and to agree on them.
I'm sure there is. You know, one of the sort of the running jokes in the world is how can we expect to agree on standards when anyone who's traveled knows they need a bag of adapters just to plug into the grid? You know, something that usually is the largest bag in your suitcase is the collection of plugs and adapters you need to just to be able to power up your computer.
Well, interestingly enough, Roger, that was also true for the telephone system. I used to have two bags, one for the
telephone
system. And that's fortunately shifted away. I think that now that we aren't using dial-up access to internet in many parts of the world and where Wi-Fi is more common, at least that's a radio-based interface, and so you don't have any physical connectors to worry about. And that's a hugely beneficial outcome. Now, we don't have, except in a small quantity, radio-based power, although you know about the work that's been going on at MIT, perhaps.
Yes, fascinating.
But it's kind of low-voltage stuff. Let me just mention one other thing, because you drew the question of power generation and Google into this conversation.
Yes.
I'm sure your listeners are well aware that Google has made fairly significant investments of its own in power generation by solar, for example. In our headquarters, I think we have about 1.6 megawatts of solar power. That probably covers maybe 25% or so, possibly a little more, of our energy requirements in our headquarters facility. So we still have a long way to go to completely provide power that way.
But impressive. That's very impressive, even that number.
Well, it's a significant investment, and I suspect that that the cost was still pretty high per kilowatt hour to use that particular technology. But hopefully, things will get better with time as we learn how to do these things better. You know, plants do it really, really well. I mean, they take the photosynthetic effect is actually stunningly effective and efficient. So we're working in that space and investing in that space as well. And so the other thing which has caught our attention, of course, are alternatives to cars that run on fossil fuels, whether it's the hybrid or all electric vehicles. The one potentially interesting possibility is that the electrical vehicles and their storage systems become part of the grid. And if they're plugged in for recharging, there's also the possibility that some of what the reservoir of power there can be used to push into the grid during periods of peak load. That sounds good on the surface, although I always get worried that the peak load happens and then I have to get in the car and I discover the battery drain. So, wait a minute. I want to be helpful, but I also have to get to work. So there are obviously some little details that have to be worked out.
As always. Well, that's fascinating, and I think that given your success in promulgating basically IP, TCP/IP, which has turned out to be the truly global standard, as you just pointed out, I think you guys actually do have a shot at making this happen, and it's fascinating. And again, just to sort of turn it back to what I had mentioned earlier, as soon as we open this up and turn the standards into basically an API that a lot of people with clever ideas can figure out ways to improve the consumption of power and our efficiencies and make interesting products and make smart appliances, it opens up again the whole area of opportunity to innovate and to make money from it.
Exactly. So, I mean, we hope that that by creating a sort of a common platform, that there will once again be opportunity for innovation. One of the interesting things about standards is that although some people claim that standards inhibit innovation, my view is that they create a platform on top of which innovation can happen.
Exactly. Isn't that the whole basis of our patent system, is that derivative ideas can arise and you don't have to start from zero each time?
Right, exactly.
Vint, I don't want to take too much of your time this morning. I know you're a very busy guy, and but I always like to ask you one open-ended question, and you've never failed to come up with something interesting. When you look out and you think about the technologies that are very nascent in an embryonic stage at this point, what do you see that you think is going to sort of come to the fore over the next few years that perhaps is under the radar a bit now and people aren't aware of, but that will become very important to us?
Well, I'm not sure that it would be, I can claim to know things that are under the radar, but let me just mention a few technologies that I'm becoming quite excited about.
Yeah.
The generic observation, of course, is that nanotechnology is rapidly being explored in many, many dimensions. One of the most interesting initiatives at the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, however, is a consideration of the potential biological hazards posed by nanomaterials. Nobody actually has a very clear understanding of what will happen as we begin to make use of nanomaterials, things that are artificial materials that have been constructed,
right.
Whether they pose a health hazard in any way, whether they might be accidentally ingested or inhaled or is otherwise, you know, we come into contact with them. And so I actually applaud the initiative at NIST to go and examine that question, working together with other experts in the medical area. It's something which I don't think has been done and needs to be done. Truth in advertising, I sit on the visitors committee on advanced technology at NIST, so I have an opportunity to see firsthand what they're doing. So I hope it doesn't sound self-serving to pat them on the back, say what that they've really taken a good initiative, strategically important initiative there. Second thing I would observe is that light sources today still create a lot of difficulties, whether it's the incandescent bulb, which just uses up too much energy because most of the 90% heat, or replacements with fluorescent materials but that contain mercury, which is a hazardous substance. So the next thing after that looks like it's LED-type materials that have very efficient conversion into photons, and also have the potential for producing this stuff over large areas, and by the way, even possibly being color adaptive, so that you could literally dial a color within some range anyway for these kinds of light-emitting materials. So I'm guessing that we're going to see some interesting explorations of these solid-state light-emitting devices over time, becoming more common in office and residential applications. The last thing I would mention is neuroelectronics. This is where we're trying to interface things to our neural systems. The cochlear implant, which was sounded like science fiction 40 years ago, of course, is now standard therapy for kids born without hearing.
Right.
And truth in advertising, again, my wife has two cochlear implants, so I have firsthand evidence that they work. The thing that I get excited about, though, is that as we understand more and more about how our neural processes work, we will understand more and more about how to emulate them so that the brain can interpret artificially generated nerve pulses as their biological analogs. The implication of that is that we may be able to help people see who are blind, or help people regain the use of their limbs who have spinal injuries. And even that, it's today in 2009, sounds a bit like science fiction, but I think that we're at the same state now where we might have been 15 or 20 years ago with cochlear implants. I believe it's predictable that we'll help people regain the use of their eyes and limbs this way. I watched also a program at DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, to build prosthetic devices that interface directly into neuromotor systems, and with stunning effect. I mean, the technologies are extremely advanced, and the people running the program have a very high set themselves a very high bar. They basically said, if you played the piano before you lost your arm, you're going to play it again, which is stunning.
It is.
Especially when you consider that it's intended to be under the same neural control that your biological hand had.
That's amazing, actually.
It really is amazing. And I see this as a highly likely, credible kind of development. So that I anticipate, too, will be of great importance. And finally, perhaps in the again, in the neural materials domain, the ability to harness DNA interpreting systems like ribosomes to generate selected proteins is actually a very, very intriguing idea, because it may allow us to harness at the cellular level the ability to produce selected structures. The things that fold up into certain shapes that we can make use of, either because of their chemical properties, given their shape, or maybe simply because of their mechanical properties. And so the idea that you could begin to create, for example, bacteria that generate desired protein sequences, which has been going on for a while, so I'm not saying anything new. It's just that I think we're looking at this in a more expansive way now, believing that we may be able to make nanomaterials, not just chemicals or not just proteins that are intended to have bioactivity, but proteins that have other applications as well. I think all of that is well underway. If you track the literature on carbon nanotubes, which is yet another area of nanotechnology, you'll find an incredible number of discoveries and explorations of the properties of these tiny little tubules, which, again, I consider to be only at the beginning of exploitation. All of this is going to materialize over the next 10 to 15 years, and it's going to be an exciting time indeed for all of us as we watch this happen.
Indeed. My mind is whirling right now just considering some of the things you just mentioned. And it's interesting, while in the 60s we were looking to outer space, if you will, to show us the frontier, now we're turning inward and looking at our nano and microscopic processes and learning from that. I think it's a very interesting change in direction.
Well, you know, Roger, speaking of looking out and looking in, I was at CERN a couple of weeks ago, and I was able to go down into the Large Hadron Collider ATLAS experiment cavity. And what is absolutely almost ironic is that the astrophysicists are now relying on the nuclear physicists
really
to figure out, you know, what might have happened at the beginning of the universe, you know, during the Big Bang. What, you know, in order to explain what we actually see now. And of course, what we don't see is the dark matter and dark energy, which we've labeled but don't quite understand.
Right.
So the large, super large, and the super small have suddenly come together and are bound by a kind of karma to help us understand the reality of our universe. It's fascinating.
It really is. It would look like a good time to study physics, too, from what you're saying.
it's a very exciting time. And, of course, what's interesting is that in order to do the experiments that will help us see and understand and maybe validate or invalidate various theories, it's an enormous collaboration. CERN, in particular, is impressive because it's a collaboration involving something like 170 countries. People at the facility in Geneva, and of course people in labs all around the world. And in a way, I felt the same sort of cohesive, collaborative atmosphere there that I still feel with the internet, which itself is a gigantic collaboration in my view.
Right.
It's encouraging to know that despite all the tensions of the world that we live in, that people really can find ways to cooperate for the benefit of everyone.
And on that note, I want to thank you. I think that was really a very interesting set of topics, Vint. And as always, it's going to take me a few days now to sort them out and think about them some more. But you've touched on some fascinating things that will be unfolding as we go. And you know, to just reflect for 1 second more, CERN, of course, is the organization that brought us the World Wide Web. Tim Berners-Lee was there at CERN and thinking of how he could collaborate better with people and the web, which is almost a throwaway, you know, from the standpoint of the kind of deep science they're working on. Look at the effect that had on the world. So it's I'm sure they can achieve virtually anything there.
Well, they certainly have had great successes so far. They're going to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the World Wide Web on March 13th, by the way. Tim did his primary work around 1989, so he's going to be there on the 13th of March celebrating with others the advent of the World Wide Web.
Well, I'm going to mark my calendar. We should all celebrate and at least go out and ping someone. Well, Vint, thank you so much. As always, it's stimulating and fascinating to speak with you. And I hope that you'll come back and join us again one of these days soon, and we can explore some of these topics.
Always happy to do that, Roger.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye. This is your host, Roger Green. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll listen again soon when I'll be speaking with more people who are shaping the future of business and technology.